Welcome back to the VeloNews podcast. Fred Dreyer here from the world headquarters of VeloNews. Another week of pro cycling jibber jabber coming into your ears. I have a great guest today, a guy I'm really excited about. Patrick Redford wrote about cycling for the website Deadspin for the last 4 or 5 years. You may have read one of his blogs. He was one of the mainstream riders who every now and again would take our niche sport and bring it to a big mainstream audience. And I'm going to talk to Patrick all about what made a good Deadspin cycling blog. If you've been following the news, you may have read that all of the writers at Deadspin recently basically walked out of the job because the owners were trying to mess with the content, really try to alter what Deadspin was doing. So we're going to talk to Patrick all about that experience. Before we get to Patrick Redford, however, though, we have to talk about what's going on in the world of cycling. A lot going on. We're going to talk a bit more about the Amgen Tour of California going away and the state of road racing in North America, because there's been some interesting news in the last week that we had on the site, which is that World Tour rider Peter Stettina, veteran of the World Tour, has chosen to abandon his road racing career and is racing now full-time on gravel. And it's just another... Just another step in the larger story of gravel coming up and American road cycling trying to figure out what it's going to be. So we are going to talk all about Pete Stettina's decision to go to gravel and endurance mountain biking. And I am psyched to talk about that with Mr. Andrew Hood, the guy who actually broke that story. Andy, you talked with Peter Stettina. What did he have to say?
Yeah, hi, Fred. Yeah, it was one of those, those little mini scoops you get sometimes just by asking a dumb question, right, as a journalist. A lot of times your best stories just kind of fall into your lap. I called up Pete talking about the Tour of California, and that was a big part of his career. When he was a racer, he'd raced it as a young guy, and, you know, he's a California guy now. So he was one of the guys we were reaching out to last week or 2 weeks ago when the Tour of California announced the big news that it was ending. Hiatus. We still haven't got the total confirmation that it's RIP, but it's a hiatus right now still officially. But then I said, well, hey, Pete, you know, what are you doing next year? And he goes, well, hey, Hoodie, I'm glad you asked. And then we got into it and really kind of a big story, right, in terms of what this means. I mean, here's a guy, one of the top World Tour pros, a staple on the scene from America, been at World Tour level for 10 years. He's had some health issues the last couple of years, but, you know, 2009, he was back at his best. And by his own choice, decided to walk away from what, you know, he says was his childhood dream was to race in places like the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia, of course, coming out of the whole tradition of the Stettina family, who were pioneers in the American road scene back in the day, and to turn away from that and to really become a privateer, kind of forge some new paths into the dusty roadways of gravel racing, the burgeoning scene. So quite an interesting story.
Yeah, I think there's a lot going on here, and we can unpack it from one topic to the next. You have two stories about this up on VeloNews.com, and I suggest everyone go and read these, to see Pete explaining why he decided to move away from road racing to gravel and just sort of the opportunities, you know, what this means and how we've seen a number of riders, really focus on versatility and break out of the road cycling mold. So I think it's, first of all, interesting that he says he's following his passion. In your story, Stettina said that, you know, when he was at these gravel races in 2019, he famously baked in a number of gravel and mountain bike races to his 2019 World Tour road racing calendar. He said, hey, you know, Trek, let's go back. I'll race on the World Tour, but I want to be able to do the Belgian Waffle Ride. I want to do Dirty Kansas. I want to do Leadville, some of these alternative races. And in your story, he said that when he was on the starting line for these races, he felt nervous. He had butterflies in his stomach. He had excitement, a feeling that he hadn't felt in quite some time in the World Tour road races, which had felt a little bit formulaic. And then the other part of it was that he started to sniff around and talk to companies and realized that he could actually put together a privateer sponsorship package with Canyon, Cliff Bar, a couple other sponsors that would get him the revenue, get him the salary and the revenue that he would need to keep going as a racer, and at the very least make it worth his while to walk away from the World Tour, where my assumption is that, look, you know, when you're on a World Tour road team, your salary is probably going to be a bit higher than when you can put it together from privateer on gravel. But, you know, if you're winning races and you're building in some incentives here and there, I could envision a scenario in which the income and revenue could definitely be worth your while. What was the sense that you got from Peter talking to him about this decision? Did it seem like it was a tough decision? Did he say it was a no-brainer? What sense did you get from him on this, Hoodie?
It certainly wasn't easy. It was not an easy decision, but it was a decision like one of those life choices you make. You know, I'm going to get married. I'm going to have a baby. You know, it's a decision that, you know, it's not an easy call to make. And sometimes you just have to kind of jump off that cliff of life to kind of make a life change. And so he said it was knocking around in his head, even already going back to last season, this past year, 2019, where he did convince the folks at Trek Segafredo to make some space in his calendar. You know, looking at his calendar this year, 2019, I mean, he raced, I think, close to 80 days, which is a lot of road days these days for a World Tour rider. You know, he raced from the Tour Down Under all the way through Guangxi in October. So, you know, he put in some miles on the road and actually had a pretty solid season, got some solid top 20 results. He was a couple of big breakaways during the Vuelta and was a key support rider through the Classics and some of the other big races he was at. Plus, you know, had some big success in his little foray into this alternative calendar. So he was just jazzed and excited about it. It's like starting a new job or, you know, changing. You know, imagine if we went from, you know, leaving Velo-News to going back to be a bartender. You know, imagine how, talking about taking a pay cut. You know, we'd be taking a pay raise if we did that job. But you know, be like, I'm quitting my job. I'm going to go move back to the ski town where I lived in college or whatever, something like that. For him, it was like going back to his kind of roots where he felt like a racer again. He felt excited to be at the races. He said the great thing about these gravel events is that you're there participating with all the public riders as well. I mean, the pros go off the front, but then, you know, the hacks like me and you, Fred, we're racing the same race coming up behind, and then they're all having beers at the keg and the podium ceremony at the end. And Peter just said he loved it because it said it reminded him of his racing as a mountain bike, you know, back at a teenager raising, you know, growing up in Colorado. That's how that scene is. It's familiar. You're there with all your friends and your family and your buddies and the guys you're racing against, your guys you're training with all week. So he felt like it was just kind of like coming home in a lot of ways. And I think there was some personal reasons too. You know, so many years on the road, so many days away from home. You know, he kind of wanted to have more time to race in the United States, be closer to home, closer to his family. And just the fact that he was so excited about it, he was taking this to World Tour teams and saying, look what I did this year. I had strong success on the alternative calendar and performed very well and consistently across the World Tour. I'm healthy again. You know, let's work out a deal. And he said he just kept running into some hurdles from kind of the old school European team managers. Just felt like that it was just kind of a distraction, or it would take away from his complete focus and sacrifice of racing and performing at the World Tour. So he couldn't find really a team out there that would allow him to do this. And he said that he had offers to stay as a World Tour rider with no gravel racing at all. And he decided that just for his personal ambitions and where he is in his life right now, he wanted us to do this gravel project. And plus the fact that you mentioned, you know, got, you know, put his word out, working through his agent, put some feelers out within the sponsor community and got a lot of very positive responses from sponsors. So the kind of the two parts of that package were his newfound passion, plus he had some real financial kind of backing to help make this thing possible.
Yeah, a couple things come to mind. First is that I talked to Pete in May at the Tour of California, and I was asking him about BWR, about, you know, he won Belgian Waffle Ride, and he was blown away. He was like, holy cow, the number of interviews that I've done and the amount of social media love that I got and the number of, like, photos of me that appeared in magazines and in websites after winning this Belgian Waffle Ride. He was like, that was bigger than anything I feel like I've ever done in road cycling. And so he, even at that point, the gears were starting to turn in his head, I could tell. And he was like, yeah, you know, I'm talking to the team about letting me do more of this stuff because it's actually really good exposure. I think something that teams underestimate is the number of reporters and videographers and people, you know, both local, regional, and international that are going to some of these races now. And just the amount of, just the amount of exposure that it gets. I've said this on our podcast earlier in the year when I was talking with Jason Kane. I'll say it again. I mean, the Dirty Kansas race report was one of our biggest stories of the year. I mean, dwarfed race reports from like the Tour de France and some of the other more traditional race reports that we do, just in terms of eyeballs, like number of people consuming it. The other thing is that I just think it's strange that a World Tour team manager would look at what he was wanting to do, especially after EF Education First had a number of riders embark on an alternative racing campaign in 2019, and they got a lot of praise for doing it. They were, you know, praised for being disruptive and different thinkers and, oh my gosh, just going outside the box. And here's this guy who's willing and able and sort of pitching his services to be able to do both, and teams wouldn't be interested. I guess that's a little puzzling to me, Hoodie, especially in 2020, and just knowing what I know about the amount of attention that that gravel gets.
Well, I think you're right. I think it shows kind of two things. One, it does kind of show how forward-thinking the EF model has become. They are kind of re-scripting a little bit about what a sponsorship deal looks like. You know, with EF Education First is really one of the first sponsors that have really come in to make a cycling team the public face of their company. A lot of teams will just use it. A lot of sponsors will use a team to promote their product. It'll be a secondary sponsorship like Movistar. You know, it's part of their galaxy of sponsorships that Movistar, which is a big Spanish telecom agency, you know, that's just part of what they do to promote their brand. But whereas with EF, you know, they have just come on, and that is the face of their company. And they're open to doing these kinds of things because it, for them, it's all about exposure and interactive with their customers and with their employees. So I think that's where EF kind of stands apart from the World Tour kind of sponsorships right now. And on the other side of that coin, I think it's a reflection, at least the resistance from World Tour managers about this whole idea is a reflection about how demanding and how intense the World Tour racing has become. The level of competition now is so high that it basically requires 24/7, you know, 9-10 months out of the year to be at the World Tour. You have to be basically on the ball all the time. Now, I mean, the pros these days, you might get 3 weeks off in November, and that's really about it. And just the level of professionalism and really dedication and the competition, both from within each team and from within these elite teams, you know, to win the Tour, to win the Worlds, to win the Classics, man, it's like you got to be 1,000% committed, eyes on that ball all the time. And anything else, like what Peter was saying, the managers thought it's a distraction. It's like, we don't want to win Dirty Kansas. We want to win Paris-Roubaix.
So there's no slack in the system. But I mean, I guess that's a very European way of looking at it, which is, okay, Paris-Roubaix, but like, you know, what about, I don't know, La Flèche Wallonne? Or, you know, I'm just thinking of as a North American cycling journalist who looks at these metrics. And yeah, I mean, is it harder to win Flèche Wallonne or Dirty Kansas? Probably Flèche Wallonne, but just the amount of exposure that winning Dirty Kansas would get your team and your sponsors, especially with all of these interested North American cycling fans who are, you know, who are interested in gravel. I guess that's a little puzzling to me. Something else that stands out.
But
what's that?
But you honestly think a Belgian sport director would care about who, you know, if you win the Flèche Wallonne, Fred, man, that's a big deal. You win the Dirty Kansas, some French sport director doesn't even know where Kansas is.
Well, like I said, I mean, that's a European way of looking at it. That's just that there illustrates the divide between what's going on in pro cycling in the United States versus what continues to go on in pro cycling in Europe, which is, you know, reverence for these big races that have been around forever and are very difficult to win. And there's a lot of cachet in winning them. And I think you can look at what has happened with gravel and say, okay, well, this is just a, you know, American cycling is going in a bit of a different direction right now. We can get into it. We'll get into it a little later. And when we talk more about the Tour California going away and what impact that's having on the scene. But here is a whole selection of these new races that are gaining popularity and a lot of people are interested in them and participating in them, as well as who's winning them. And there is, you know, the interest in this amongst North American cycling fans is actually maybe surpassing the interest in some of the traditional Euro stuff. What I was going to say is something else that comes back to mind about this past year with the whole non-traditional racing schedule was that you know, I was writing a lot about this, and when EF announced that, hey, we're going to send some of our riders to some of these non-traditional races, I wrote a piece basically saying, that's great, but, you know, these guys are not guaranteed to win. I know that some of the riders who specifically focus on Dirty Kanza and specifically focus on Red Hook Crit and some of these other non-traditional races that they were thinking about, it's like, yeah, these guys are pretty strong, and they focus entirely on this one event or on these groups of one events. And so, and there's a lot that can, that has to come from trial and error at these races in terms of gear setup and pacing and strategy and stuff like that. So I wrote a piece that was like, they're not guaranteed to win. And I got some reply on Vodders on Twitter saying, well, you know, winning isn't the point. We're not actually going there to win. We're just going there to sort of, you know, add to the scene and whatever. And I guess what I appreciated about Stetna is that when I called him up to ask him about it, he was unflinching. He's like, no, I am going there to win. I want to win these races. I look at something like the Dirty Kanza and I want to win it. I want to, you know, have the best gear, the best training, the best whatever. You know, think of it analytically like any other bike race and develop a plan to win. And I was really psyched when I talked to Stetna about it, because I was like, I feel like that's the right attitude to have with these guys going to these races. It's like, it means more for the race if a world-class road racer like Peter Stetna is going there to put his best foot forward and try to win. And you know what? He won Belgian Waffle Ride, didn't win Dirty Kanza. I wrote about it on the site. He had that big battle with Colin Strickland that was, you know, captured people's imaginations, and it was this great duel under the sun for 100 miles. But he, you know, these guys are not guaranteed victory at these big races, which I think is cool.
Yeah, it was interesting talking to Peter too about that, exactly that kind of approach that he's going to bring to really the next season in 2020, because he said this year he really was just kind of riding off of his world tour form. Basically, he said he would kind of parachute into these races, didn't really have a lot of specific training. He said especially it hurt him out at races like the Leadville 100 and the Dirty Kanza, which were just these longer bruising endurance races where, yeah, I mean, it translates into, you know, riding in a world tour event that's 220Ks, but, you know, riding on the fat tire on the gravel road or the mountain bike, you know, it's a whole different kind of effort. So he said that's what's going to be interesting for him too, is how he'll have to change his training and see how his body will adapt to these kind of new demands of his racing calendar for next season, where he said he's going to mix in, you know, he said he'll mix in some gravel racing, some endurance mountain bike racing, as well as he hopes to, you know, fit in a few road races as well. He said, you know, he said he's not going away. He's still going to be a professional rider, a full-time racer. He said it's not like some sort of vanity project or some sort of way to postpone his retirement. He still considers himself a full 100% professional racer.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to something that has changed even in the last few years with American gravel and sort of this alternative racing calendar, which is that there's actually enough events now and enough big high-profile events now that you can string together a pretty good racing campaign. You can race year-round in gravel, mountain bike, and, you know, smaller regional road races if you want to. You can actually string together a decent amount of exposure for the sponsors and enough races to keep you focused. So I was writing down some names here. I mean, Belgian Waffle Ride, Rasputista, Land Run 100, Dirty Kanza, the Crusher and the Tusher, this new Big Sugar gravel race that's going to be in Bentonville, Arkansas. There's the Steamboat Gravel, Leadville 100, and I'm sure I'm leaving out more and more, you know, a bunch of different races there. But it's like you start to add up the number of these races, and, you know, you start to see a guy like Peter Stetna. It's not like one or two races for the whole year. That's a pretty good racing campaign.
Yeah, he'll be busy. And he also mentioned who will be racing in some events in Europe as well. I don't have the names of those events right now, but he did mention that there's two or three events on his calendar in Europe as well. Because, you know, the scene's taken off really across the entire cycling community. You know, in Australia, it's getting big. In the Americas, we're seeing events in Europe. And, you know, it kind of reminds me, Fred, I mean, you might have been around back in the day. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you are, but I remember back in the day, the late 80s, early 90s, when mountain biking was really taking off. And you kind of get that feeling. It's a little bit like that sense of a new discovery for you're a cyclist. You know, back when the mountain biking really took off, it was such a boom for the industry. I think we're seeing a little bit of that in the gravel right now, and you're wondering if it's kind of almost a fad. I mean, people would get into it. Everyone's going to buy their gravel bikes. They'll start racing. You know, maybe in 5-7 years, it'll hit that saturation point, and then it will kind of start to taper off. That's just a natural cycle of, I guess, the business cycles. But what it's doing is it's just energizing the kind of racing scene. Everyone's kind of getting into riding their gravel bikes. You know, it's safer. You're not out there riding in the traffic, and it's fun, man. These races are fun. It's a kind of racing that a lot of people can do. You know, you don't need, you know, perhaps, you know, you ride a crit, man, you know, you're going to break your collarbone sooner or later. And in mountain biking, you know, you have to be like a, you know, you have to have the technical skills to race on a mountain bike as well as the engine. You know, mountain biking is hard to race. So I think a gravel ride is a race, you know, you can have those different levels in during the day of the race. You're having the pros and the semi-pros off at the front. Then you got a group of riders coming in behind, and then you got even, you know, a shorter distance just for the weekend warriors. So it's a great scene. It's really taken off, and it's pumping a lot of energy into the racing scene and the bike industry.
Yeah, it's true. And so that's a good segue into the next point I wanted to talk about here, which is after we had the news last week that the Amgen Tour of California is going on hiatus. And look, those of us who know this sport well enough know what that means for big North American bike races. Very few of them come back from hiatus. I saw a lot of chatter online, and I even got some web letters basically saying, well, you know, that's just a sign that North American bike racing is dead, you know, or is dying. And, you know, I was down in Colorado Springs this past week at USA Cycling's headquarters, and they had all the race promoters and a bunch of team directors from the Pro Road Tour out there. And we sat in a room and talked about what's going on with the scene. And again, you know, this topic of like, oh, is North American road cycling dead came up, because 2 years ago, we had all these stories around this time of year of a lot of the pro road teams being in trouble and either dissolving or having sponsorship problems or having to downsize. And again, this story of, oh, American cycling is dying kept coming up and up. And I've been trying to wrap my head around this thing, because I don't actually think that North American cycling is dying. I think that, okay, maybe World Tour North American road races like the Amgen Tour of California have obviously died and are dying, and there's just not a sustainable model there. But when I look out at the landscape, I do see these disparate parts of American cycling, American bike racing, that are doing really strong. And it's almost like someone smarter than me needs to find a way to unite these disparate parts into some type of scene or ecosystem that feeds the rest of the thing, that helps create a more robust model. So I mentioned I was at this USA Cycling thing with all these race promoters. And, you know, there's this thought of, oh, pro road racing in the States is dying. Well, the funny thing is that a lot of the promoters for some of these big regional road races and crits actually had really great stories of success to tell about robust regional sponsorship portfolios and participation numbers that were still pretty strong, and you know, big Cat 5 and Cat 4 fields and criteriums and citizens rides and grand fondos that they were putting on. And you know, okay, maybe it's no longer the days of Navigators Insurance and Saturn and Health Net battling each other week in, week out at, you know, Redlands and everyone following along. But it sounds like some of the regional pro races are actually doing pretty well. Then you look at the gravel thing. Obviously, the gravel thing's doing really well. Every 6 weeks, I feel like there's a new big time gravel race being announced for 2020. Nika is doing great. Bunch of new kids getting involved in the sport, coming in and mountain biking and learning to love competitive cycling and getting on bikes. I did a story a couple months ago about how some of these races are innovating with new technology to drive down the cost of live streaming broadcast. Like, that's a positive story to tell. And then again, like these, you know, these regional pro races and people who are still passionate about road cycling and competitive cycling, it seems like that, okay, maybe there's been some erosion there, but it's not like the whole thing has gone away.
And plus, the track scene is doing very well with the USA Olympic team. They just came off their road team just came off their most successful road worlds in a decade.
Yeah.
And we have a new generation of both men and women coming into the pro ranks. So it's not all doom and gloom out there.
No, it's not all doom and gloom at all. And in fact, there's so many strong components of it that, like, to call it doom and gloom and to say that American bike racing is dying is just completely, you know, it's just neglecting so many of these bright spots. Again, what strikes me is, like, someone who's smarter than me needs to be able to, like, maybe draw one of those, like, mind maps like you see in, like, a detective movie where the detective is, like, following somebody and they have, like a yarn board on the wall, you know, where it's like the picture of the guy and then yarn goes over to another guy and goes over to the document and sort of like mind mapping it out, you know.
Well,
and it's like you have this wall with all these like weird components of American bike racing that are strong and yarn connecting them all, and some zany insane genius sitting in their apartment looks, stares at it for like, you know, 48 hours and comes up with the answer. That's my challenge to you, listeners.
It sounds like you're the Zodiac killer there, Fred. Yeah. Trying to map out your next victim. Well, you know, it's always been the same problems though with North American racing trying to slot it in to fit in with the European calendar, right? It's like Tour California was in February, worked great there for a lot of reasons, and then moved it to May, and it worked good there for other reasons, and losing out on some other side of the equation there. And that's always been the kind of the big problem with, you know, where do you fit in a race in North America that fits in with the European racing, that you can still attract all the top pros. And that's a problem that cycling has had here for 30 years, and it's going to be a problem for the next 30 years.
Yeah, and I almost wonder.
It's not to say that regionally there aren't all kinds of interesting races and events out there, because cycling at its core is a participatory event. It's like people ride their bikes. They don't want to watch people ride their bikes. They want to ride their bikes themselves and perhaps even do it on the same day. That's why the Gran Fondo scene is taking off. That's why you know, even things like electronic bike racing, you know, with the Zwift. It's like, because you can do it yourself.
And I almost wonder if, you know, we need to let go of that thought for a while of trying to bring big European road racing over to the States in general and trying to get the Euro teams over here and try and just create another, just a different ecosystem, one that still has the ability to funnel young, talented kids up through the ranks, that gives them opportunities to, you know, dream and hope of one day getting to the Tour de France, but also serves participant cyclists across the country who are interested in gravel and Gran Fondos and, I don't know, the local crit scene and Zwift. It's almost like, like I said, we need to rethink the model in general over here. Of course, that will always create tension between what goes on in cycling in North America and the rules and desires of the UCI, which is a European organization by and large. But, you know, I just look at too many success stories in North American cycling for me to really believe the argument that, you know, even the argument that like road racing is dead here.
Yeah, let's just hope that you know, there's lots of bright spots, and let's hope that something can perhaps fill that space that California had on the calendar. And, you know, maybe this gravel alternative racing trend will just kind of fuel a new base in American cycling, and then that will grow into something else.
Well, Andy, we can hope and we can pray that gravel and some of these other up and coming bright spots in American cycling do just that and help fuel the next generation and the next iteration of what American cycling is going to turn into. Well, Andy, I appreciate you chiming in today. We will catch up with you a week from now. But now let's turn our attention to Patrick Redford from Deadspin and catch up with the interview I did with him. My guest today on the Velo News podcast is a guy who has written about cycling for audiences far larger than us fans of Velo News. His name is Patrick Redford. He was at Deadspin for more than 4 years. And Patrick was a Swiss Army knife of sports coverage, writing about everything from the NBA to rock climbing to soccer stories that I never really understood to also cycling. He was the author of such blogs as Let Me Explain This Hilarious Cycling Scandal to You, Dumbass Causes Gnarly Bike Crash While Just Walking Into By Just Walking Into the Middle of a Race, and Errant Helicopter Clauses Real Dumb Bike Crash. Patrick Redford, thank you so much for coming on the Velo News podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm sensing a strong theme in my work there. And if I had my way, you know, I would explain hilarious cycling scandals weekly. Those were just my favorite stories to write there.
So the Let Me Explain This Hilarious Cycling Scandal focused on the Zwift cheating scandal that took over bike media for an entire day, where the champion of the great of British Zwift indoor esports, whatever you call it, racing championships, was disqualified for, I mean, just a really trying to explain it. I love that the blog was called Let Me Explain This Hilarious Cycling Scandal. But just explaining it about how this guy had used an illegal simulator to unlock some glowing bike that he used in the championship competition, and someone went back in time and saw he, you know, there's a lot going on there.
So yeah, curious, none of the nouns in that story are immediately parsable by the Deadspin audience in general. And so, you know, if the headline in the blog was sort of about British YouTuber who happens to moonlight as e-racing star, which is a sport for some reason, disqualified for Tron bike tech manipulation scandal, I think about five people would have read that story.
I know, and you nailed it with the headline, and I feel like you also nailed it with just like what it's about, like the explanation of how bizarre this story is what may suck a mainstream reader in. So I mean, did that one light up the airwaves? Were dead spinners just falling over to read about the Zwift scandal?
You know, somehow they were, because I think it hits what made, you know, my favorite Deadspin stories, which is it's very dumb, but in a very rigorous way. You know, like there's nothing sort of inherently interesting about you know, a lot of the factors in that story, but when they all come together in such a breathless way, and you have this dude doing a 16-minute YouTuber apology directly into the camera, like the comedy of that sort of transcends the cyclingness of it all, which is sort of, you know, whenever we could find those little moments to bring to our audience, that was, you know, I was all about that. I was very happy to do those stories.
Well, I'm always curious about this as someone who writes about cycling for a cycling audience, but has written about cycling in the past for a mainstream audience. When I was a freelancer and I wrote a lot for the Wall Street Journal, I was constantly pitching these stories about cycling culture, pro bike racing to the editors there. And I was always wondering, like, why some stories would get picked up, others would not. They tend to love stories about doping and amateur cheating for some reason. I guess a question for you then is, like, what's the secret sauce from your experience that goes into a cycling story that's going to connect with the masses?
So I thankfully had the freedom of sort of writing about whatever interested me. And I would write plenty of cycling stories I know would get, you know, 6,000 readers or something, which is, you know, an order of magnitude below the average for any sort of in-depth blog, but it was something I cared about. However, like, the times I knew it would sort of blow up was when you have absurd things happening in the Tour de France in particular, because that was, you know, a traffic cash cow for us. And also, like, these weird little scandals. Like, it doesn't necessarily even have to be about doping, but, like, you know, moto doping was, like, that was, I followed that story for about a month or so and wrote, you know, five or six blogs about it, and they're all quite popular. And I think, like, something that Deadspin has done particularly well, and there's a particular type of story, is just explaining in very plain terms, like, it's all about characters, essentially. And, you know, and you can find these characters in cycling. It doesn't really matter what sport they're doing, but if it's funny or interesting, our audience has shown the patience, did show the patience to follow you down those trails if you made it worth their while.
I think another element about cycling that helps connect with the mainstream is the fact that there's so much video of it now, and so many ridiculous things happen during the field of play. So I'm watching this blog from the 2018 Tour de France. A few asshole Tour de France fans took it too far today, and it shows some idiot running alongside the front group and, like, patting Chris Froome on the back.
Yeah, that was, what, a year after there were all those big crowds and he had to run up the road in his cycling cleats?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and so, I mean, was that when he got punched? Because I remember, like, you know, obviously Froome and Sky and Ineos now were big villains for us, and as they should be. And so we covered them very harshly. And their PR people were always yelling at me about being fair. And I was. And, you know, to the point where if people are dicks to him, like, we were obviously going to cover it in that way. And I think because, you know, people didn't really read the stories very much. I mean, you can look at the numbers. They're still on the website. Like, the early, when I first started doing bike spin stories, you know, late 2015, no one cared about it. There really was no cycling coverage on Deadspin before. And it's really rewarding to see how we managed to sort of build up a following of, you know, otherwise uninterested Deadspin readers who, through the continued, you know, scrolling path and ignoring the headlines, finally found some things worth reading about. And, you know, I really enjoyed being the sort of the Sherpa into this world they would have otherwise no interest in. Like, you know, they trusted me to bring only the, I mean, not only because there were a lot of boring blogs I wrote too, but, you know, primarily, like, I would point out when there was something worth their time, I suppose.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like having looked at these pages and pages of your blogs, you honed in on a lot of the elements of cycling that, yes, while ridiculous, also are parts of the sport that I always try to emphasize to my non-cycling friends when trying to explain it to them, which is like just how different and wild and kind of free it is compared to traditional sports where, you know, you're in a stadium and there's a rule book and there's decorum. And like, you know, if a pitcher looks at the batter funny, they're going to like, you know, that's like a big deal. Ooh, ah, ooh. And meanwhile, it's like in the Tour de France, like the guy who's winning the race falls off his bike and has to run alongside the road and fans are like throwing beer at people. And just like the results are being influenced by these crazy outside factors that, you know, no one can control. It always blows me away when it happens about how cycling is this like wild and free sport that like it really is at kind of the whims of like Mother Nature and the fans standing alongside the road.
Yeah, and the culture is so different, and I think particularly because it's a sport that's so invested in its history. You know, like there, like Eddie Merckx is still revered as a giant, and all these races are always doing, you know, 30-year tributes to Cipollini or whoever. And so, I really do appreciate that the lived history of the sport is so revered by its fans and so part of the culture every day. And I think that's like one of the things. I mean, obviously in baseball and basketball and football, like everyone knows who Jim Brown and Babe Ruth were, but there's not that direct connection. That's something I really did enjoy about cycling that I found unique.
Oh man, I forgot this one about the video where the kangaroo just completely annihilates the cyclist.
Yeah, that was what, like a 2-sentence blog? You know, we could also, thankfully, because we didn't have to, I mean, I think we were freed by not having necessarily a niche audience sometimes, so we could just do dumb small stuff. We could explain things in a general way that, you know, UofL news couldn't necessarily do just because everyone knows, you know, who Matthew Vanderpool is or whatever.
Yeah, and you know, we don't have to spend three paragraphs explaining it to you. But I guess what I always appreciated about your coverage, Patrick, is that you were succinct in your explanations. Like a lot of times when I read about mainstream cycling in like, you know, The Guardian or even the New York Times, it's paragraph after paragraph trying to explain the nuance and like wrap it in context. And like, I feel like you are brief enough and succinct enough where like the reader is going to understand it, but you're not giving them too much information.
I suppose you have to trust the reader, you know?
So let's get back in the Wayback Machine. It's 2015. You come on board at Deadspin and you go to the editors and say, hey, look, there's this niche sport, 100 years of great history, wonderful champions, amazing scandals, completely goofy stories. Puts people to sleep oftentimes because it's so boring. I want to write about it. What was your pitch and what was their response?
So I first started freelancing during the 2014 Tour de France. And I had just graduated college and was furiously pitching every editor I could find. And Tommy Craggs, who was still the EIC at the time, let me write about that very kind of not good Tour de France. I just got to write about, you know, Nibali dominating. I wrote a brief Nairo Quintana profile, and I think it sort of fit their mold of, you know, we're not necessarily going to be all things to all people. We're not going to be, like, we're not the New York Times. We're not going to be the authoritative voice on who won the race or not, but there is like a crucial part of the model was allowing enthusiasts to, like, geek out and kind of do their thing. And so, you know, those blogs did weirdly good traffic, I think just because there was no bike riding on Deadspin whatsoever. And then as I came on as a weekend and night person, I found, you know, thankfully the moto doping scandal happened right as I was about to transition into full-time employment there. And so I think my bosses kind of saw, perhaps there is something in this, you know?
And then as you progressed there, I mean, did you find yourself refining your coverage, like kind of, you know, honing in on what made a Deadspin cycling story?
Yeah. So, you know, I initially had the, you know, inkling because I wasn't as experienced in writing stories every day and working with an editor and pitching and all that good stuff. I wanted to do a lot of, you know, boring shit. I wanted to write just like, here's what the spring classics are. Like, hey, Paris-Roubaix, that's a cool race. And so as I kept going and you know, working on my approach, I realized you have to just take very specific angles. Like, I would talk about Roubaix through the prism of A Sunday in Hell and just sort of do like a film review slash look at this weird bike race. And thankfully we had the luxury of ultimate freedom. That's why, you know, it was my favorite place to work and why it was a dream job, is because you could kind of write about whatever you wanted. And so within this big world of bikes, with no one else really competing for stories at the site or in like the mainstream American media, I kind of had the luxury of picking and choosing whatever I wanted, whether it was news or a weird feature or talking to some pro Conti team about going to Iran. The wide breadth was really, it was really refreshing.
Now, you bit off a lot of controversial topics, which I appreciated. And I know from my own experience when writing about controversial topics in the bike space, the cycling fans tend to be pretty feisty on Twitter. I wouldn't claim to say we have the feistiest group of niche sports fans out there on Twitter, but here's a question for you. I mean, how, in your experience, did cycling fans compare to other niche sports fans in terms of their just get swimming in your mentions and like lobbing bombs at you?
They're delightful, man. Like, I've pissed off, I've pissed off MMA Twitter a couple times, and they are just the most intolerable group of online people ever. I called some minor league MMA organization a minor league MMA organization, and I had, you know, half the UFC roster yelling at me and just thousands and thousands of people, and it blew me away. With cycling, it was only ever British and Irish fans and big Team Sky fans who would yell at me, but like very politely. They would often send me, you know, considerate 400-word emails couching all their criticisms. And, well, I understand, you know, it's a harsh time. And then some people would just sort of be like, you know, respectfully, sir, I disagree with your take about albuterol or whatever. And they're always, you know, wonderfully pleasant to deal with, mostly because I'm used to just the really bad stuff.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I'd heard before that the UFC fans could be, or just Ultimate Fighting fans, MMA fans in general, can be a little
incredible,
fiery. And like, they get pissed even if you're a mainstream writer writing about their sport, just like not even in a critical way, just like if you could venture in there, they're like,
if you're a filthy casual, that's the worst thing you can be, which is so funny with most other sports. Like, hockey has the self-deprecating slogan, please like my sport. You know, they're begging for people to write about it. But there's just something about, and I guess it's sort of the fan base that's been actively encouraged by, you know, the powers that be. But like, there's, you know, they only want the most elite. I mean, it's pro wrestling nonsense, but this is an MMA podcast, so.
You could just imagine some shit-headed man, like sweaty man, screaming at you. Well, I guess that is something that I have noticed with cycling fans on Twitter, which is that when someone like you, or, you know, definitely like Jason Gay, dips his toe in every now and again, people tend to be very appreciative, and maybe there's a little correcting going on, but really it's sort of a like, hey, thank you for shining a microscope on my favorite sport today. I love it so much. I hope other people get to love it as much as I do. Thank you, sir. Oh, and by the way, you know, Chris Froome's Vuelta is still pending, looking at the salbutamol, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, it's like, I respect your take. However, if you look at stage 16 of the 2017 Giro, where Nairo won based on snow disqualifications, he in fact should not have picked up the 3 minutes he did. However, great blog. Thank you very much. We love you. Like, honestly, though, I wrote cycling stories were a very small percentage of my output, probably, you know, less than 5%. But I got the most positive feedback and feedback in general from people who didn't get to read about it at other major publications. And I'm under no illusions that I was, you know, the best cycling writer, even a particularly good one, considering like the whole field of everyone who works for the cycling only media outlets. But I think just because we spoke to such a different and larger audience, everyone was appreciative of that, which is really cool to see. You know, I dig that.
Well, there you have it, cycling fans. I appreciate it too. Now, you know, I guess my advice is that whenever any other mainstream journalist dips the toe into cycling and does so in a way that is completely non-offensive, like Patrick over here did with his great blogs about, you know, dumbasses causing crashes and stuff, like, give him a little social media love, pat him on the back, send him a happy face emoji.
But not Jason Gay. Call him a filthy casual. Tell him I sent you. He'll love it.
It's true. God, he's such a noob. Okay, Patrick, let's move on from your bike blogging. I want to hear the story of Deadspin, because, you know, some listeners may not be as interested in this as I am, but, you know, Deadspin was one of my favorite sports blogs, and over the last half year or so, the thing, you know, it basically melted down. It went through an ownership change bought by a private equity firm called Great Hill Partners. They installed new CEOs and managers who seems like pissed everybody in the staff off, fired the interim editor-in-chief, Barry Pachesky, who'd been there for a long time, and basically everyone on staff decided to quit all at the same time. You know, I want to dig into this entire timeline, but I guess a good place to start is, you know, April 2019, when Great Hill Partners takes over. Did you guys have any inkling at the time that, you know, it was going to be this really bad fit for Deadspin?
Well, that's kind of the funny thing. We kind of, you know, because Univision had owned us for 2.5 years since Gawker went bankrupt in April 2016. And Univision took over right before the election, so I guess I think September. And because we were this very small part of this $7 billion portfolio, which had been saddled with all this debt problems because they bet big on live TV right before the recession and right before cord cutting, we were sort of constantly under siege. And it was very baffling because the Gizmodo Media Group, as it was known back then, sites, you know, were in a vacuum profitable. However, because we were part of this huge portfolio, management clamped down on us. There were occasional layoffs. There was a big wave of buyouts. And eventually they sold us for, I don't remember what the exact figure was, but they bought Gawker for $135 million and they sold us at a heavy loss. And so we thought, I mean, initially and optimistically and incorrectly, as it turned out, we thought that being bought by a smaller firm who bought us at a discount, they would be happy to, you know, take this distressed asset, give us what we needed, and find the profit that was very obviously there without their mismanagement. And, you know, at the time, we met with Jim Spanfeller, the CEO, and we had a couple all hands, and he seemed, at least initially, very receptive to say, you know, I have my doors always open. You can talk to me. We like the sorts of stories you're doing. We want to go bigger on, you know, investigations, more original reporting. We just thought, you know, finally, the Univision days are behind us. This can only be a good thing. It was not.
Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with Deadspin, it was one of the most popular sports blogs out there, not just for covering sports, but because of the unique voice, the blending of humor, investigative reporting, writing about sports, but then also the intersection between sports and culture, sports and politics, lots of topics outside of sports, sports and food, or just food.
Yeah.
The fact that that was a sports blog where, you know, sports got you in the door, but there were all these other written pieces about culture and food and politics and fashion and just goofy things written in this amazingly funny voice, that's what got people to come back. And it seems like one of the points of tension here was that maybe like Great Hill didn't like know that. Like maybe the people who bought it actually didn't realize what made Deadspin a success.
You know, it's very baffling, and Deadspin I think achieves popularity simply because we actively eschewed bullshit as much as possible. Like we didn't really treat our readers like dum-dums and do, you know, a bunch of slideshows and here's one amazing trick to do whatever. It was a certain honesty and a certain freedom that all the writers had to just write about kind of what they cared about. And sports obviously very obviously does not stop when the players leave the locker room. You know, there's this whole other, you know, the entire sports is the world. You know, there's publicly financed stadiums for billionaires. There's sexual harassment policies in all these major Olympic organizations. There's the NFL's, you know, decision to turn to this extrajudicial body and adjudicate suspensions for arbitrary reasons. Like these are all sports connected stories, but simply reporting the news of who won the game or whatever is an act of disservice to readers who, you know, engage with sports so much and could therefore stand to like learn about the world and everything affecting them. So that was the general pitch of Deadspin. Does that seem right?
Yeah. And it sounds like that as this new marriage went forward over the course of several months, the new owners really didn't appreciate that. Didn't like the stories that touched on some of these topics or on topics that were outside of the sports. In August, your acting editor-in-chief, Megan Greenwell, resigned after a staffer, Laura Wagner, published a great investigative piece about the owners, which I was like, holy cow, you know, sports website publishes investigative piece about sports website's owners.
It was a good blog too. It was clean. It was fair. I mean, they gave Jim way more time than he deserved to answer those questions, which he did. And a really wild 4,500 word email to all the staff, which is basically to the public because obviously it was going to get leaked at some point. But I mean, there were a couple points of tension with Great Hill from the start. And one of them was the no reporting on ourselves. I mean, so they came in, they tried to institute all these blanket policies very quickly, including, you know, a dress code, mandatory drug testing, all these things from this really wild employee handbook, which we figured out within 10 minutes was just copied and pasted en masse from some form employee handbook. And, you know, really incredible stuff there. The other was the now infamous stick to sports memo. They told us, you know, stick to sports. You can write about President Trump being booed at a World Series game because that intersects with sports, but things that are not directly tying into sports you cannot cover. And if you're saying that to our staff at this point, then you just have a fundamental misread of what we do. Like, non-sports stories, traffic-wise, outperformed pure sports stories consistently forever. We were having our biggest traffic months ever in 2019. And through the summer, too, when there aren't sports happening, and we write a bunch of movie reviews and all this other stuff.
Yeah, like, I remember watching a video of one of your coworkers, Dan Quaid, petting an enormous kitty cat. Like,
I'm glad you brought that up, because Jim apparently was pissed about that. Like, that video, this 28-pound cat infuriated him. He was so mad at this cat, and then we put it on our site. And, you know, to Megan's credit, she had been dealing with these edicts behind the scenes and sort of keeping their layer of management nonsense from the staff. And so she was ousted in August. And Barry was fired 2 months later in October for, they sent another memo that says stick to sports, blah, 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 whatever. And so we did a day of non-sports stuff. We had, you know, blogs about a pumpkin thief. Dom Costantino, our wonderful NFL writer, broke down tape of a bear, you know, entering a motel, you know, good pad level, not very explosive, but some serious strength on him. You know, it's what we've always done. We put in the skybox some of our greatest, you know, non-sports stories hits, like a blog about the man who played Viggo the Carpathian in one of the Ghostbusters movies that did, you know, a million views and is one of the greatest stories ever published on Deadspin. If you don't understand that there's a value in that and that our readers, like, there's such a loyalty to the website that our readers feel, then, like, why would you buy it in the first place?
And then in, I would say, one of the more amazing American media moments of the last 10 years, after Barry Pachesky is fired, you guys all made the decision to leave with him. So set the scene for me. Where are you? What's the conversation like? Take me through this. I guess you were not there. I mean, you work remotely.
Yeah, I was in the woods. So I've worked remotely, you know, the entire time. I've spent probably 2-3 weeks in New York total. I just happened to be visiting. I know, it's great. Just live in San Francisco, ride my bike around Golden Gate Park. It's a nice life. But anyway, I was visiting my girlfriend down on the farm where she lives in a very remote part of Southern California. And so it was this very strange disconnect between, you know, peaceful outdoor nature space and then just absolute turmoil at work. And so Barry gets fired Tuesday. I guess there's another crucial piece of context here, which is that Jim and the rest of the management side put these just horrible autoplay, unmutable video ads all over our website, which is something straight out of, like, the 2009 internet that hasn't been – that's this actively alienated readers that people don't do it anymore. So we did that. We all published a post on all the sites saying, hey, the ads are bad. We think the ads are bad. We had nothing to do with it.
Was that post part of some, like, sponsored content piece for the advertiser, you know? It's just, like, integrated, you know?
The ad modern, was playing on those posts, yeah.
Modern advertising.
And they did good traffic, so maybe we put ourselves in the corner. But so we post those posts and say management wants to hear your feedback. And then within a couple hours, we can see that our CTO, Jesse Knight, deleted all those posts, just pulled them, put them back into drafts. And, you know, the deletion of a post is, you know, Gawker had a really big blow up over this 4 years ago. And the deletion of a post is one of the strongest possible red lines to cross. And so that was happening at the same time as the stick to sports memo. And because we had been told to stick to sports several times and sort of, you know, we thought the arrangement was like, yes, you have to say this. But we're obviously not going to do that because we've never done that. We thought the bigger crisis was the deletion of the post. And so then Barry was fired over the stick to sports memo. And we had a meeting directly after. We all We all conference called in, all the remotes were on video, and it became very clear that a site that would fire Barry over that and delete posts over nothing was not something we could get behind. And so it was fairly immediate that it became clear that there was going to be a mass defection. And then over the next day, you know, it became very clear we were meeting with the rest of our union about any possible actions. And it became clear there wasn't really a drastic route that was going to be taken. We all quit. And this was right after, on Wednesday, meeting with Paul Maidment, our editorial director, where he came in the room thinking, I'll simply smooth this all over, tell them to get back to work, and it'll be fine. Our minds were made up then. We have the meeting, and then 5 minutes after, the emails start rolling in. And by Friday, every single one of us had quit, including people with kids. Drew McGarry, who has, you know, serious medical issues after, you know, he fell and hit his head and almost died last year. Like, the bravery of those people to walk away from this job because of, you know, because if they believed in it so much and they believed in our coworkers and supported Barry, like, it's genuinely amazing. So we all left.
Yeah. And that's a question I have for you. How old are you, Patrick?
I'm 27 and a half.
You're a young kid. No. I've worked in media my whole career. I worked in New York City media. I've been laid off from jobs. I've applied for jobs at Deadspin before. I've always held Deadspin up as a great site that I always loved to read and thought, you know, you guys did amazing work. And as you guys were resigning from this position, the question I kept asking myself again and again was like, wow, would I have the cojones to do this? Because I have a kid now. I know how difficult it is in the media space right now, how, you know, big major publications are laying people off and letting people go. Good people are losing jobs. And to, you know, draw a line in the sand, which you guys did, and said, look, this is, you know, this crossed the line to the degree that, you know, we don't want to work here anymore.
This aggression will not stand, man, as it were.
Will not stand. I mean, was there, well, like, take me through, like, I guess the personal emotional journey of going from being mad to being ready to resign, knowing that it's a tough world out there.
I mean, I think being on the farm honestly helped because it all felt very abstract to me. But there came a point pretty quickly where on Tuesday when Barry's fired and the walls are coming down, and, you know, I think people sort of fundamentally misunderstood the terms of what Great Hill wanted. There was always hope that, you know, they'll just reinvest and the sites will be profitable and then they'll flip us and sell it to someone else. And we should have seen this when Megan was basically forced out, which is that their explicit model is to find this undervalued asset, squeeze what you can, strip and sell it for a quick buck. And so, I mean, we know that these are not people who care about journalism or care about us. We're just numbers in a spreadsheet to them. And once they delete posts and fire Barry, there was no way I could write another blog for them. I couldn't. It wasn't going to happen. I think everyone else felt that way. And, like, you know, we had this meeting and it was made very clear to everyone that, like, if you choose to stay, that's your choice and it's fine. Like, we'll support you. You're not a scab. Like, you have kids, you know, Dave McKenna's got two kids. Drew's got three kids. You know, if you need to keep this job and the health insurance, that's a completely valid choice to make. And so it was always sort of up to us. But then once I sort of realized that a lot of my editors and our leadership and my closest friends were going to quit, that it was no place for me anymore. And so it was a hard decision. It was my dream job. And it was the hardest thing I've done. And, you know, the outpouring of support, from the public, from Bernie Sanders, who said Jim Spanfeller is a vulture online, which was wonderful. For everyone else, has been genuinely heartwarming. And I think, you know, once we're all stable and on our feet elsewhere, that we'll be able to look back on it more with pride. But it was a hard thing.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And, you know, I always appreciated reading your bike takes and takes on rock climbing and all these other things. And I saw you as a guy with a really good perspective on lots of different sports. And so to lose that voice, you know, I mean, we all suffer from it. I give you lots of credit for having the bravery to do that. Again, I keep asking myself if I would be able to do that in a similar situation. I have a kid, you know, like I said, I've been on the outside looking in and it's not fun. So the fact that all of you, you know, felt so strongly about this to make that decision, you know, I give you all a lot of credit.
Yeah, I mean, I really do appreciate that. you know, thank you for reading and for supporting us. But I think another thing is it had become clear for months that there was no real future for us under Great Hill. It was either going to be they sell us or the site just kind of slowly dies. And, you know, maybe it's naive, but all of us who worked at Deadspin really believed in the Deadspin project. And if it was going to just turn into some zombie shell of itself, like to us, and we're lucky enough to be able to say this as one, but that's not something we could get behind. And so here we are.
Well, I suppose it also frees you up then, Patrick, to come up with all of the amazing bike blogs and bike story ideas that you were never able to write for Deadspin that you can now write for Velo News.
You know, that's not a bad idea.
So let's see here. Perhaps. Got Matthew Vanderpool just completely annihilating all the cyclocross people. We have American pro UCI racing completely cratering. We have gravel racers. Yeah, it's a lot of stories out there for you to sink your teeth into, buddy.
Yeah, McNulty profile. That'd be a good one.
Yeah, McNulty. Another question I have for you, and this is totally off topic. You were the person who was on the beat of the Mad Pooper. Right?
The Mad Pooper, yes.
So this was a story that, as a Coloradan, I followed closely. Apparently, down in Colorado Springs a few years back, there was a jogger who was defecating in people's front yards.
That's very true.
Like, regularly. And
one woman in particular was targeted multiple times.
And you were on the blog. You wrote about it, and I think you guys even put the APB out there of, like, if you have any information about who may be this Mad Pooper.
Yeah, I called the Colorado Springs Police Department so many times they told me to please stop contacting them. They'd let me know if they had more information. And the police, the PIO only answered his phone because I have a 916 number and we're both from Sacramento. And so if he'd been, you know, they've been inundated with calls. But I think, you know, I was very close to figuring it out who it was, and Tim Marchman was very close to approving the budget to send me to Colorado Springs for a week to try to track down and find the Mad Pooper. And unfortunately, it didn't come together. But, you know, that was a fun and very dumb story to pursue for a month.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of endurance athletes out there, maybe who run. And, you know, if you know the identity of the Mad Pooper.
Yes.
Search Patrick out online. Well, again, Patrick, doors always open if you want to write about cycling for us. I always appreciated your voice, your reporting, and the stories you chose to do. So no matter what the future holds for you, keep us in mind.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for talking to me, as always.
All right, Patrick. My guest was Patrick Redford of Deadspin, who wrote the bike spin element of the site with such amazing stories as Zwift cheating and ridiculous crashes. There's a great one, too, of like cyclists punching each other in the head. Just whenever something wacky in cycling would happen, you were on the beat.
Our audience loves dumb stuff.